The Voice of Reason Broadcast Network presents The Mark Weber Report. Mr. Weber is a historian, author, current affairs analyst, and director of the Institute for Historical Review. Visit the IHR at ihr.org. And now, Mark Weber.
Hello and welcome. A false flag operation is a destructive, violent attack carried out by agents of a government that then blames the attack on others to generate support for its policies. One of the most widely repeated allegations of a false flag operation is the Reichstag fire of 1933. An arson of the German Parliament building in Berlin. For nearly 80 years, it has been widely claimed that the Reichstag fire was organized and carried out by high-level Nazi officials, who then blamed the crime on communists to generate support for measures of the Hitler government to suppress dissent and consolidate power. On the evening of February 27, 1933, fire broke out in the ornate German Parliament building in central Berlin. A young man from the Netherlands, Marinus van der Lubbe, was arrested at the scene of the crime. He readily admitted setting the fire. He had been a member of a Dutch communist group. He said that his motives in setting the blaze was to encourage an uprising against the new government headed by Hitler, which had taken power a few weeks earlier. Not surprisingly, German officials immediately assumed and publicly charged that the arson attack was the work of communists. The next day, an emergency decree was issued and signed by President von Hindenburg that authorized arrests of communist activists and which suspended civil rights sections of the German Constitution. Communist groups, for their part, immediately claimed that the Reichstag fire had secretly been set by the Nazis themselves in order to create a pretext for imposing dictatorial rule. Communist publicists organized a large-scale propaganda campaign, especially in Western Europe, to support this view, which was also, of course, the official view for many years in the Soviet Union and in the communist-dominated countries of Central and Eastern Europe from the end of the World War II until the collapse of the Soviet Empire. Here in the United States, this view has been promoted, for example, by the American historian William Shirer, in his influential and seemingly impressive book, The Rise and Fall of the Third Reich. Shirer's phenomenally best-selling work has, for decades, probably been the single most influential work in the United States about Hitler and Third Reich Germany. Many Americans who regard themselves as informed and well-educated accept Shirer's portrayal of history as accurate and reliable. In his book, Shirer wrote that, although the whole story about the Reichstag fire probably will never be known, and I'm quoting here, there is enough evidence to establish beyond a reasonable doubt that it was the Nazis who planned the arson and carried it out for their own political ends. Shirer goes on to claim that a small detachment of Nazi stormtroopers made their way to the Reichstag building through an underground passageway and set the fire using gasoline and self-igniting chemicals. The idea for the fire, Scheirer went on to write, and I'm quoting, almost certainly originated with Goebbels and Goering. Scheirer continued, quote, von der Lubbe, it seems clear, was a dupe of the Nazis. He was encouraged to try to set the Reichstag on fire, but the main job was to be done, without his knowledge, of course, by the stormtroopers. Unquote. The Reichstag fire trial, which was held during the latter months of 1933, generated intense media coverage, both in Germany and internationally. The defendants in the case, in addition to the young Dutch citizen, were prominent communist activists, including one German, Ernst Torgler, and three Bulgarians. The most important of the Bulgarian defendants was Georgi Dimitrov, who was later head of the Comintern, the international network of communist parties headquartered in Moscow, and who also, after the end of World War II, was premier of communist-ruled Bulgaria. During the trial proceedings, Dimitrov praised the Soviet Union and charged that Hermann Göring and other high-ranking Germans had themselves set the fire. At the conclusion of the trial, the court, as expected, found Marinus von der Lubbe guilty. He was sentenced to death. But the court rejected the arguments of the state prosecutor regarding the other four co-defendants. Because there was no evidence to show that they had been involved in the arson, the court acquitted Torgler, Dimitrov, and the other co-defendants, and the four men were soon released. The impartiality of the court and the obvious fairness of the trial, as shown by the verdicts, is just one indication that the Reichstag fire was not a false flag operation. As already mentioned, Ernst Torgler was the only German defendant in the trial. He had been a communist member of the German parliament. In fact, Torgler was head of the Communist Party faction in the Reichstag, and he was publisher of a Communist Party news sheet. William Scheirer, in his book, The Rise and Fall of the Third Reich, claims that Torgler continued to be held behind bars until his death during the Second World War. The truth is quite different. In fact, Torgler was released a short time after the conclusion of the trial. And then something remarkable happened. In June 1940, he began working for the German government, appropriately enough in Goebbels' ministry working on anti-communist propaganda. At the end of World War II, Torgler obtained a position in the municipal government of a German town under U.S. occupation. Torgler repeatedly and angrily dismissed charges that he had been forced to work for the Goebbels propaganda ministry, and instead insisted that his wartime employment had been entirely voluntary. Torgler died in 1963. Now, over the years, the false flag view of the Reichstag fire has been widely repeated and publicized. In recent years, the claim that the attack was secretly organized by the Nazis has been promoted in the United States by, among others, Jesse Ventura, the colorful former governor of Minnesota, and by Alex Jones, an outspoken radio commentator with a hyper-conspiratorial outlook. Well, what do historians make of the Reichstag fire today? If you look at the Wikipedia entry on the Reichstag fire on the Wikipedia website, you'll find this, and I'm quoting, "Historians disagree as to whether von der Lubbe acted alone or whether the arson was planned and ordered by the communists or by the Nazis, then dominant in the government themselves, as a false flag operation. The responsibility for the Reichstag fire remains an ongoing topic of debate and research." This is misleading. In fact, for all but a handful of neo-Marxist or vehemently anti-Hitler historians, the basic facts are now well established. In 1960, Fritz Tobias, a West German public servant and part-time historian with leftist views who supported the Social Democratic Party, wrote a series of articles about the Reichstag fire that appeared in Der Spiegel, the prominent German weekly magazine. In these articles, which were later turned into a best-selling book, Tobias presented detailed and persuasive evidence to show that von der Lubbe had acted alone. He showed that von der Lubbe had been a pyromaniac with a history of burning down or attempting to burn down buildings. In particular, Tobias established that von der Lubbe had attempted to burn down a number of buildings in the days prior to the Reichstag arson. At the time his articles first appeared in 1960, Tobias was widely attacked for supposedly exonerating the Nazis. Today there is hardly a single serious historian who still accepts the view that the Reichstag fire was set by Goering or other Nazis. The consensus among historians today is that von der Lubbe amazingly acted on his own. Now, this was difficult to accept because the fire took place very quickly, and a fire of this scale, it was hard to believe, could have been carried out by any single person. But the evidence overwhelmingly is that von der Lubbe acted alone. Because it seems very difficult to believe that he could have acted alone, it was understandable that many Germans assumed that there had been a conspiracy in which other communists were involved. One aspect of the discussion about the Reichstag fire and a corollary of the view that it was a false flag operation is the notion that without the Reichstag fire, Hitler could not have consolidated his hold on power in Germany. Well, that notion, as attractive as it is to some people, is simply not true. Hitler's popularity in Germany after he was named Chancellor did not depend on, by any means, on the pretext or the occasion of the Reichstag fire. His popularity increased dramatically after he was named Chancellor on January 30, 1933. Now, it's important to put this in some context. The National Socialist German Workers' Party, the Hitler movement, was already in 1932 by far the largest political party in Germany. It had almost 50% of the support in the German Reichstag, the German parliament, and had already obtained dominant support in some of the regional governments in Germany. It was much larger than any other single party or even grouping of parties in Germany. By all justice, Hitler should have been named Chancellor of Germany already in 1932 as leader of the largest single party in the parliament. But because it wasn't had not yet secured majority support in the parliament, the president, Paul von Hindenburg, was reluctant to name Hitler as chancellor and to give him the authority that he wanted. So when Hitler was named chancellor on January 30th, 1933, he headed a government in which members of his party, the National Socialist Party, were actually a minority. Most of the members of the cabinet of the Hitler government were not members of the National Socialist movement. The vice chancellor, Franz von Papen, who had been a chancellor earlier, was a member and a leader in the German National People's Party. And the Hitler government took power in 1933 as a coalition of the National Socialist German Workers' Party along with the German National People's Party. But the steady and dramatic increase in popularity of the new government was shown by several things that happened in those in the months after Hitler was named chancellor. The, as already mentioned, the emergency decree of February 28, 1933, was not a necessary one for Hitler to consolidate power. It was an emergency decree signed by the president. Now, it's also important to remember and keep in mind that for more than a year before Hitler was named chancellor, German governments had been ruling by emergency decree. Chancellor von Papen, von Schleicher, and Heinrich Brüning had only very small and very limited support in the German parliament. And they ruled as and governed as chancellor only under emergency decree authorized by the Constitution with the support of the president, Paul von Hindenburg. The Hitler government was the first government in a long time which actually had a majority of support in the new Reichstag. An important landmark event in securing consolidation of power of the new government came on March 23, 1933, several weeks, almost 4 weeks, 3 weeks after the Reichstag fire. This was the passing of the so-called Enabling Act. Now, Hitler probably could have taken power in Germany through just taking by force. But Hitler, in order to secure a broad base of popular support, insisted upon acting in conformity with the Constitution. The Enabling Act of March 23, 1933, in order to be passed, required a two-thirds majority in the parliament. That's because the Enabling Act meant setting aside some of the provisions of the German Constitution. So, in the debate that took place on March 23, Hitler was able to plead for support, authorizing, in effect, sweeping, unusual, extraordinary powers by pointing to the need for special authority to deal with the enormous problem of unemployment during the in the throes of the Great Depression. Now, it's not an exact parallel, but in the United States, the new government of Franklin Roosevelt also passed a number of sweeping new laws after it came to power in March 1933 with support in the U.S. Congress that were extraordinary. And in fact, some of them were so extraordinary that they were later declared unconstitutional by the Supreme Court. In the discussion about the enabling for the Enabling Act on March 23, there was a remarkable debate between the head of the Social Democratic Party in the parliament, whose representative was Otto Wels, and Hitler. The two men argued for and against supporting the Enabling Act. And although Otto Wels spoke persuasively and eloquently in his address, Hitler's response was at least as equally persuasive and eloquent. And most Germans found that Hitler's arguments in favor of the Enabling Act were the more compelling. In any case, the Enabling Act was passed easily by more than two-thirds of the parliament. It had the support not only of the National Socialist Party, Hitler's party, but also of the German National People's Party, of the German States Party, which had also of the German Democratic Party, and of the Center Party, which was overwhelmingly a Catholic party, and of the Bavarian People's Party, a regional Catholic party. The only party to in the parliament at that time to vote against the Enabling Act was the Social Democratic Party. But in spite of that, the act passed in the parliament with some 83% of the votes in the parliament, well more than was required to suspend certain sections of the German Constitution. Now, as mentioned, the Enabling Act was only one of a number of landmarks of events during these months in which the National Socialist Party was able to consolidate its hold on power and its base of support and broaden its base of support. Another important event came on May 1st, 1933. In the weeks just before that date, the German Labor Federation, the General German Labor Federation, which was had been very close to the Social Democratic Party, had compromised itself to the point that it was offering to collaborate with the National Socialist Movement. On May 1st, 1933, enormous rally was held in Berlin and in other German cities of an expression of and support for the German labor movement. And the General German Labor Federation, which, as mentioned, had been close to the Social Democratic Party, urged its members to show up and turn out in support of this enormous expression of support for the new government. On that day, the new Hitler government declared May 1st to be a paid holiday for German workers. This was the first paid holiday in German history. Now, one of the significances of this is that for many years, the Social Democratic Party in Germany had been urging and calling for the establishment of May 1st as a national holiday, as a paid legal holiday in Germany, but it had never succeeded in actually making May 1st a national holiday. So when the new National Socialist government declared May 1st a national holiday, this was very impressive to millions of German workers who had more regard for the actual acts and deeds of the new National Socialist government than they had for the rhetoric and words of the Social Democratic Party, which for years had tried but failed in doing what the new Hitler government did. So the May 1st rally was an enormous expression of popular support by German workers for the new National Socialist government. The next day, May 1st, 1933, the German labor movement was dissolved and a new organization, the German Labor Front, was established to secure the interests of German workers in a new organization that would unite and consolidate both the interests of German workers and of German employers in one large organization. In effect, strikes were abolished and replaced by compulsory arbitration. But the German Labor Front was not merely a pretense or not merely words. In fact, in the years 1933 through the remaining years of the Third Reich, the German Labor Front organization seriously, authentically, conscientiously did promote the interests of German workers in Germany, and in case after case, when disputes came up between employees and employers, in the overwhelming number of cases, the officials under the new German labor legislation decided on behalf of German workers and against the employers. But the popularity of the German Labor Front organization as a replacement for the Trade Union Federation was genuine and real for most German workers, who regarded it as a real and authentic representation of their interests. Another important event in the steady consolidation of power came a few weeks later, on May 17, 1933, when Hitler delivered the first major speech to the German parliament on foreign policy. This was an eagerly awaited address by the German leader, and at that time was important because the other political parties in Germany still existed at this time. And so Hitler's speech was presented not merely to a Reichstag, a parliament made up of members of his own party, but also of representatives of other political parties, including the opposition Social Democratic Party. Well, we'll take a break at this point and return in a few minutes, in a few moments, with the second half of this broadcast of the Mark Weber Report.
Stay tuned for more of the Mark Weber Report. You're listening to VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com.
Well, Europe's ongoing struggle to save the euro has been dealt another blow, as Portugal has had its debt downgraded to junk status. Moody's, the credit rating agency behind the move, says a default is likely unless the country is given another bailout. Many analysts have questioned the logic of saddling struggling economies with more debt, as speculation grows over whether the EU is ready to come to Portugal's rescue again. Now to discuss this, we're now joined by Douglas Carswell, an MP from the British Conservative Party. Thank you for joining us today. So Moody's says that Portugal, like Greece, may need another bailout. Is the EU ready for yet a fifth round of bailouts, do you think?
I think it would be immensely foolish to have another bailout, because what we're doing with each so-called bailout is adding to the amount of debt owed by countries who are already bankrupt. This is the first time in history we've had an IMF presided over bailout that is, if you like, ladling more water into the boat. If we really want to fix this problem, instead of adding to the debts of Portugal, Greece and other countries, what we should be doing is three things. We should be devaluing their currencies, that means leaving the euro. We should be allowing them to default on their debt, restructuring if you prefer that term, and we should be forcing them to downsize their expensive bloated public sectors.
If I may, there are some that are saying that all of this bailout money, it never goes to the people. It just goes to the banks and the governments as they continue to line their pockets. Some say this is the biggest bout of financial fraud in broad daylight. Your take on that?
I think that's a pretty fair summary. I mean, for example, in Greece at the moment, I think 42% of total debt is owned by foreign private institutions, mainly French and German banks. By so-called bailing out Greece, we're not helping Greek people. What we're doing is we're transferring that debt burden onto the shoulders of European taxpayers. It's frankly an outrageous scam, and I think it will mean that, you know, my children and my children's children will have vastly higher tax bills. It's not right. It's not good for us in Western Europe. It's not good for Greece. It's not good for Portugal.
So you call this an outrageous scam. So where's the outrage with the people? We see the riots in Greece, but shouldn't there be a larger movement across the region to bring down the fat cats as they continue to line their pockets and just foot the bill to the people?
Well, when big business and big government get together, I think we should all start to count the pounds or euros in our pockets. I think we clearly see in Greece that people are very upset, but I think we're increasingly seeing people in the rest of Europe getting increasingly upset, because I think they're not, you know, the people are not stupid. They understand that these bailouts are adding to the debt burden. The way you deal with the debt problem is to reduce debt.
Let's return to the Mark Weber Report, brought to you by VOR.
Hello and welcome back. When we went on break, I was talking about the speech by Hitler to the German Parliament, the Reichstag, on May 17, 1933. It was an important landmark in the consolidation of support and of power by the new National Socialist government in Germany shortly after, in the months after Hitler took power on January 30, 1933. Now, the significance of this speech on May 17th is that it was the first lengthy, detailed, comprehensive address by the new chancellor on foreign policy. It's important to put this in a little bit of context. When Hitler came to power on January 30th, 1933, Germany had essentially no allies in the world. It was essentially an isolated country. It was surrounded by nations that were either hostile or indifferent to the new regime. Unlike the United States, countries in Europe, it's important for countries in Europe that they much more clearly define their relationship with other countries because they border on other countries, and what happens in neighboring countries plays a much bigger role in their affairs than it does for the United States, which on two sides has large oceans and isn't immediately affected by neighbors. In any case, Hitler's address was important, widely anticipated, and many expected that the speech would be a belligerent and hostile address. Certainly that was the expectation of those who had accepted the view of the new government by its enemies. That's why Hitler's address on May 17th was all the more remarkable for its measured, logical tone. The main point that Hitler made in the speech was to appeal for equal rights for Germany and an appeal for peace and an appeal for conciliation with other countries based on equality of rights and equality of responsibility. Hitler stressed very strongly not only the injustice against Germany after the end of the First World War by the imposed by the Versailles Treaty. He stressed especially the double standard of the victorious Allied powers in imposing the punitive peace treaty of Versailles on Germany after World War I. It's not well known, but the severe restrictions on Germany according to the Treaty of Versailles are based in part in the Versailles Treaty upon a pledge by the Allies to disarm their own countries as well. The demand that Germany, which was imposed by the Versailles Treaty, give up a navy, an air force, large artillery, and to have a very limited army of no more than 100,000 men was justified by the Versailles Treaty on the basis that this was part of a general disarmament that was going to take place throughout the world. But although Germany fulfilled the provisions of the Versailles Treaty and restricted itself to a very limited military force without any heavy artillery, with no navy, no air force, no submarines, the Allied powers, for their part, failed to abide by the provisions of the Versailles Treaty. Most notably, France continued to maintain an enormous military force and also had, during this period of time, conscription, a draft, whereas Germany did not have a draft. Its 100,000-man army, as provided for by the Versailles Treaty, was a volunteer force. Now, in his speech of May 17th, Hitler made a number of proposals consistent with the stated claims and the stated policies of the Allied powers for equal rights that would reduce the danger of war in Europe. Specifically, Hitler said, "Germany will be perfectly ready to disband her entire military establishment and destroy the small amount of arms remaining to her if the neighboring countries will do the same thing with equal thoroughness." Hitler also said, "Germany is entirely ready to renounce aggressive weapons of every sort if the armed nations on their part will destroy their aggressive weapons within a specified period, and if their use is forbidden by an international convention. Hitler went on, Germany is at all times prepared to renounce offensive weapons if the rest of the world does the same. Germany is prepared to agree to any solemn pact of non-aggression because she does not think of attacking anyone, but only of acquiring security. Now, Hitler's proposals were so reasonable and so modest that around the world, Hitler's speech of May 17th was widely applauded. Unfortunately, though, neither France nor Britain nor the United States nor any other country took seriously or responded in any forthcoming way to the specific proposals made by Hitler in this speech for reductions of armaments and for international agreements to restrict the use of aggressive weapons, offensive weapons, and so forth. But more noticeably than that, in the Parliament, this address by Hitler on foreign policy was considered at the time so reasonable that it received the support not only of those parties which had supported the Enabling Act of March 1933, but even the Social Democratic Party, which had opposed the Enabling Act, endorsed Hitler's speech on foreign policy. It was the kind of speech that even a social democratic chancellor could have delivered, and which the social democratic members of the parliament, of the German parliament, in fact supported. Now, the fact that the Social Democratic Party, even the Social Democratic Party, supported Hitler's plea for equal rights, for reductions of armaments, and for international agreements on reducing the use of offensive weapons was very widely regarded with approval among the German population and helped to further secure the popularity of the new Hitler government in the German among the German people as a whole. This is important because it's often claimed, as I mentioned earlier, that the high point of Hitler's popularity was at the time he became chancellor in January, or perhaps in March or whatever of 1933. In fact, the popularity of the Hitler government increased steadily during the months and in the years afterwards, so that the national referenda or plebiscites that were held in Germany in 1936 and in other years, 1938 and so forth, that reflected overwhelming support by the German population for the policies of the Hitler government were authentic in that they reflected the genuine feeling of the German people at that time. Now, this wasn't merely because of clever propaganda. This wasn't merely because the German government was impressive in its in parades or in rhetoric. It was also because the measures of the National Socialist government in reducing unemployment, in eliminating really unemployment within several years, and of restoring economic vitality and prosperity in Germany were widely approved and accepted and supported overwhelmingingly by the German population, by the German people. So much so that around the world, what Hitler achieved in those few years was a model or an exemplary achievement for many other countries as well. Now, this may all seem pretty fantastic to many people when they think about all of this, because it is so contrary to the view that we have of the National Socialist regime and of the Hitler regime in American motion pictures and magazines and books and so forth, dominated above all, of course, by propaganda about the Holocaust. But the propagandized view of Hitler and the government and so forth is so ubiquitous, so widespread, that it's very difficult to realize for many people just how widely accepted that is. Now, one example of this is one that, in a way, I'm guilty of even in this very talk, and that is my use of the term Nazi. Now, the term Nazi, which is widely used even by people who regard themselves as objective and as discerning and educated people, is the use of a propaganda term. The term Nazi is a pejorative. It's a demeaning term for the National Socialist Movement. It was especially widely used by communists because communists wanted to avoid any mention of the term National Socialist, and preferred instead to call the Hitler movement either Nazi or fascist. Both terms are really not only inaccurate, but they're pejorative. The communist movement wanted above all to avoid any implication that the National Socialist Movement was in fact socialist. That is, it was genuinely concerned for and representative of interests and the real interests of the mass of German people and of German working people. And it's attained such widespread use that it's used nowadays. Now, it would be as if Americans were to refer over and over to the leaders of China today as commies. The word commie has something of the same pejorative, demeaning tone that the word Nazi does. But it's been so widely repeated in propaganda in the United States and a leftover, in many ways, of World War II propaganda that it's still widely used, even by people who are trying to be or consider themselves to be objective. In the German language, the term Nazi and commie both have this pejorative tone to them, this demeaning tone. But they're not confined to those two words. Americans in popular usage in Germany are referred to often as Amis. It's in the same way that Nazi National Socialists were referred to as Nazis and so forth. Now, Ami isn't always a pejorative, but it has a kind of demeaning undertone to it. And people, of course, do not themselves refer to themselves, except in a self-deprecating way, as Amis. But again, the very fact that the term Nazi is so widely used in American society is an expression of the extent to which a propagandized, pejorative term has become widely accepted in the American culture and the American media about this chapter of history. This past month, June 22nd, represents the 70th anniversary of one of the most important events in world history, and certainly one of the most important events in 20th century history, the beginning of the June 1941 attack against the Soviet Union by the armed forces of Germany and its allies. On June 22nd, and in the weeks afterwards, the huge attack against the Soviet Union on a front extending all the way from the Arctic Circle in the north to the Black Sea in the south involved not only the armed forces of Germany, but of Finland, Romania, Hungary, Italy, Slovakia, Croatia, and then later with armed forces or volunteer contingents from France, the Netherlands, Belgium, Spain, and other countries as well. This struggle, this enormous battle between the Axis forces on the one hand and the Soviet forces on the other, is by far the largest military campaign in modern history, by far the largest military campaign in World War II. As I've emphasized on a number of occasions, Americans because of the way it, World War II is presented in the American media and American motion pictures, often fail to get a real sense of the enormity of the struggle on the Eastern Front. Just a few facts. Something like three-fifths or at least two-thirds or three-fourths, the overwhelming number of German forces were destroyed, not by American military, but by the Soviet military on the Eastern Front. The Soviet military and the German military, in sheer numbers and in firepower, were far, far greater than what America threw into World War II, especially in the European theater. As I said, as I pointed out on a number of occasions, the high point for many Americans of U.S. involvement in the campaign against Hitler's Germany came with the D-Day attack, the D-Day invasion of June 6, 1944. But by the time American forces landed at Normandy in June 1944, the tide of war had turned decisively against the Axis and in favor of the Soviet Union. Already the critical battles of Stalingrad of late 1942, early 1943, and the last major German offensive on the east at Kursk in the summer of 1943 had already been fought and had already been lost by the Axis forces. After the summer of 1943, there were no further major German successes on the Eastern Front. And so when the American forces landed at Normandy in June 1944, the war had already really been decisively determined on the Eastern Front by that time. Now, as mentioned earlier, this is the 70th anniversary of the opening of the Barbarossa attack against the Soviet Union. Now, a couple of things were in the news recently on that attack. Just the other day, the president of Romania caused some outrage in Russia for stating in an interview that if he had been the Romanian leader in 1941, he would have supported the attack against the Soviet Union. In that regard, he cited the justification for Romania's attack because a year earlier, the Soviets had taken by force a Romanian territory of Moldova and also of North Bukovina, in violation, by the way, of the agreement that the Soviets and the Germans had signed in 1939. Of course, in Finland, the attack against the Soviet Union was widely supported because a year earlier, the Soviets had attacked Finland on a pretext and had seized a good chunk of Finnish territory and caused the deaths of many people. There were good grounds for regarding, of course, the Soviet Union as an aggressive and dangerous power. And that's why when German forces crossed the border in June 1941 and entered into Lithuania, Latvia, Estonia, Ukraine, and so forth, they were widely, almost universally, greeted joyfully by people as liberators from Soviet rule. This is hard to understand for many Americans who are used to the propagandized view of World War II as brutal, tyrannical German forces coming in and imposing grim rule. In fact, in country after country where German forces entered, they were welcomed as liberators from the country, the Soviet Union, which was America's most important military ally ever. During World War II, America's most important ally was, of course, the Soviet Union, and the alliance between the United States and the Soviet Union was highlighted by the meetings in person between President Franklin Roosevelt and Soviet Premier Stalin in Tehran, Iran, in 1943, and then again at Yalta in the Crimea in February 1945. So the remarks by the Romanian president just the other week justifying the 1941 Barbarossa attack against the USSR may seem strange to many Americans, but it's not strange to people in Romania or Eastern Europe who have a better understanding and memory of what Soviet rule meant during those years. Another item that was in the news recently was the revelation of some documents that reconfirmed that Stalin was ready in 1939 to deploy more than a million Soviet troops against Germany in cooperation with Britain and France to fight against Germany during that period. In fact, the negotiations for collaboration between France and Britain on the one hand and the Soviet Union on the other in 1939 broke down because the Poles did not want to give permission for Soviet forces to enter into Poland with the well-grounded fear that once Soviet forces came in, they wouldn't be removed and that the Soviet Union would impose its own rule over Poland, which is in fact what happened. But the understanding the story behind the German attack against the Soviet Union in 1941 is crucial, I think, for an understanding about World War II. Especially since the fall of the Soviet Union, the collapse of the Soviet Union, more and more evidence has come to light to show that the Soviet dictatorship of Joseph Stalin was in fact preparing to attack Germany in 1941, or some historians believe in 1942, and that the German attack against the Soviet Union in June 1941 was first and foremost not an act of mad aggression, but was a preemptive strike carried out against a force larger than that of Germany that was threatening to overwhelm not only Germany, but the entirety of Europe. In that regard is an interesting article that appeared a year ago in a prominent Israeli newspaper, Haaretz, about the background to the Soviet Union, but background to the Barbarossa attack in 1941 and the role of the Soviet Union. Tom Segev, a prominent Israeli historian, cited a document that had only recently been made public, and he wrote this: "The history of World War II may have to be rewritten. It was Stalin's fault," writes Tom Segev in Haaretz. The document he cites is from October 1939 and consists of three pages in English that purportedly reflect a dialogue in Moscow between a delegation from Czechoslovakia and a senior Soviet foreign ministry official. The Czech communists tried to find out why the Soviet Union had signed the non-aggression treaty with Germany, the so-called Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact of August 1939. And of course, a few days later, the Germans invaded Poland, and World War II began when Britain and France declared war against Germany. The Soviet official, whose name is Alexandrov, explained to the Czech delegation that had the Soviet Union signed an agreement with the West, Hitler would not have dared to launch a war. And without that war, there would have been no possibility of imposing communism in Europe. The Soviet official also listed the benefits to the Soviet Union of the pact with Nazi Germany and of the war. This document is just one of many other documents and pieces of evidence to show that the attack by German and other forces against the Soviet Union in June 1941 was very different than is portrayed in American media and propaganda today. That concludes this broadcast of the Mark Weber Report. Please join us for future broadcasts.
Thanks for listening. The Mark Weber Show returns Wednesday, 10 p.m. Eastern U.S. Time, only on VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com.